Well, this coming November will mark the centenary of Einstein's publication of his field equations. Glycon, Durkheim-Wittershon, published in Poisson-Wissenschaft Academy, November 1915. And it was followed by his paper, Grundlagen der allgemeinen Theorie, in March of 1916, which is a complete description of his theory up to that time. So here we are. I'm talking about modifying gravity. Why? I first have to try to convince you why I would want to modify this beautiful theory. And so I'll start with that. This is the contents. I won't waste too much time on this. So the main motivation comes from the issue of dark matter. Zwicky, the Swiss astronomer, discovered that the Coma cluster is not stable. It's not realized unless you introduce new forms of matter, so-called dark matter, 1933. So that's some 82 years ago. And things heated up with dark matter around the early 70s. Room and Ford discovered that stars moving around circular orbits and galaxies don't move fast enough according to Newton's laws. So this heated up the idea of having dark matter present in the galaxies as well as the clusters. So far, no dark matter particle has been detected in laboratory experiments and satellite missions after considerable effort. So an alternative explanation for the galaxy dynamics and cluster dynamics is to modify Newtonian and GR gravity. So I'm going to introduce a theory of gravity which will demonstrate that this is possible. And we'll discuss that. The conundrum. This is the pie of matter and energy, as we've all seen before. And the issue is that me, consisting of protons and neutrons, is insignificant, 4% or so in the universe. And the rest is this mysterious dark matter. And then, of course, we have the dark energy problem, acceleration of the universe. That's today, and this is what it would look like about 12 billion years ago. And the dark energy was not relevant at that time. Okay, so this is the latest. This is the 25th March issue from Scientific American. That the Earth goes around 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy, and it picks up dark matter. It heats up in the center of the Earth, and it causes volcanic eruptions. Also, it knocked the orbit of the comets around so much that they hit, one of them hit the Earth, and the dinosaurs became extinct. So there's a good use for dark matter. These papers are published in MNRES. So, all right, experimental data that must be explained and fitted by, I call it MOG, modified gravity. MOG is also the name of a rock group But this is more than just rock music, okay? It also means, it can also stand for modified gravity, Moffat gravity, but I don't do that, of course. Now, we have to fit all this data if you want to survive as a modified gravity person, or in fact, any gravitational theory. And, well, it's pretty overwhelming. All of this has to be explained. If you can't explain it and get a consistent result, you're dead. You go back and start over again with another theory. GR, of course, does not, by general relativity by itself, without some dark matter and potentially dark energy or whatever, cannot explain all this data. So we end up with the latest item that has to be fitted. This is the Event Horizon Telescope, the VLBI. This is coming into operation within 2 or 3 years, and this should test general relativity for strong gravitational fields. Most of the other tests, of course, are for weak gravitational fields. Okay, this is the action. The goal is that I should be able to write down an action. It's not too difficult. And explain everything. Okay. This is an ambitious program. It's been going on for, with this particular theory for 10 years. So of course I have a lot to say, so I have to swiftly go through a lot of these slides. At times I feel like a Sisyphus pushing up a large rock up a mountain face. And on the rock is printed modified gravity from Greek mythology. Okay, so...
S is what?
So S is the action. And SG is Einstein-Hilbert, the usual. And these are, this is a vector field that comes into play, a massive vector field, called a phi mu, potential phi mu. And these are scalar fields. Big G varies like Jordan brand sticky. And mu is an effective mass of the vector field. And these are potentials for these fields. And here, and that's it. It's fully covariant theory. So this is the action for pressureless dust, and Q is the charge of the vector field, and it's purely gravitational. It's equal to the square root of alpha G Newton times the mass. So mass is the only source of gravity in the theory.
John, so in the previous item, what is B an independent field, or is it the derivative?
Phi mu is an independent field from the metric.
Is B the form from your vector field, or is it independent?
Sorry, which field?
B, you have B.
B mu nu is the curl. I'll come to
okay.
That. Curl of phi mu.
And let me just ask one thing. If I do a transformation on the metric to absorb that factor G to get it to what at least I refer to as Einstein training, is this just Einstein plus?
It's just primal.
Plus a scalar vector theory, or is it?
Jordan Brand sticky with a vector field.
Okay, so why do you modify gravity?
Well, because it's not GR. GR is not
okay,
this.
Okay, so GR plus, so if I want to describe this as GR
yeah.
plus a particular matter, then that would be accurate.
That's correct. Okay, so Q is chosen to be positive in order to fit data, and alpha is a parameter. And Q is chosen to be positive, so that there's no chance of neutralization with respect to this Q field, getting rid of the vector field. So when you work out the acceleration law for a test particle, it takes this form. It modifies the Newtonian acceleration by this Yukawa contribution. And for extended distributions of matter, we have this. And photons form null geodesics, as they do in GR. Now, let's get into it. This is the picture of the universe from Big Bang. And when stars, the first stars of galaxies form, this produces a division for me between what we would call dark matter and no dark matter. And so the cosmology is based on my mentor, Freeman Robertson Walker, background, the usual. And these are the contributions to the density, the T naught naught. And these are the Friedmann equations that come out by variation of the action. First and second Friedmann equations. Lambda is a cosmological constant. So we assume a spatially flat universe because the Planck 2015 data tells you the universe is spatially flat to about 1%. I'm driven by data. The theory is self-consistent. It's the second-order differential equations, hyperbolic, no ghosts, no problems, no instabilities. So we don't have to worry about that. We have to worry about the data. We've got to fit what nature tells us to fit.
So you say there's a scalar field that couples to matter, right?
Sorry, what?
So there's a scalar field that couples to matter.
G, like G, and
yes.
Mu.
Yes, so they couple to matter. So you're saying self-consistent, but if there is a coupling to matter that does not preserve any shift symmetry, there's going to be radiative corrections to the mass. So there is a problem with radiative stability.
I don't agree. Jordan Brunstig is stable except for pathological cases.
No, it's not stable radiatively.
If you're given reasonable initial conditions, it's a stable theory. A lot of other gravity theories are not stable.
Why is the scalar field light? That's the question.
Well, we'll get to that eventually. Okay, so G, big G is equal to G Newton times 1 plus alpha. And I'm assuming for the moment that it's early universe cosmology, but it's not the Big Bang with very high densities. So G dot is of order zero, and G double dot is of order zero. And the Friedmann equation is reduced to this. And I do perturbations. This is the Poisson equation. And I have this scenario. There are five components to the energy density. There's a neutral pressureless fine particle, gamma prime, so-called hidden photon. There's baryon matter, photons, neutrinos, and dark energy. But my dark energy is explained by the simplest explanation, the cosmological constant. I believe that the cosmological constant problem will eventually be solved when we understand how quantum gravity affects the vacuum. We don't know that yet. So the cosmological problem, I think, will be solved. And lambda is a simple solution for the description of the data cosmology. Okay, so these are the energy densities we have, and this is what I assume here. Alpha is less than 1. At the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, we have this, so we get the same results as Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And at horizon entry before decoupling, the density of the vector field rho is much bigger than the baryon density. After decoupling, rho phi becomes of order rho baryon, and then when we have the first stellar and galaxy formation, rho phi, the density of the vector field phi mu, dilutes considerably, the baryon density takes over. And then we explain all the present day dynamics with a modified gravity, with enhanced gravitation, not due to dark matter. That's the scenario. Okay, so we worked for rho phi much greater than the rho baryon. These are the equations.
Mu
is the mass range parameter. I will get to this. This is an important point. Okay, the Jeans equation, this is standard stuff. It's the vector field gamma prime acts as cold dark matter in the early universe, and the speed of sound is zero for that particle, and we get this equation, and you just work out the structure growth. And this is the structure growth here for the hidden photon, cold dark matter photon. These are the plasma oscillations due to the baryon photon plasma, baryon electron plasma, before recombination, before the surface of light scattering. So we get the usual picture from this. This is an explanation, in quotes, of the cosmology. If you just put in dark matter and two cosmologies, it's a phenomenological statement. This comes out of an action principle. Okay, so this particle, the phi mu, a lot of papers have been published the last few years on the axions and these dark matter photons. We heard from Nima this morning about the axions. And the idea is that you shine a light through a wall and you get a conversion of the photons we know about into the dark matter photon, and then it goes through the wall, you get another conversion, and you can do cavity experiments. There aren't such experiments are ongoing at Stanford at present. So if we consider two U, one neutral phi mu's, then this is a potential Lagrangian, which is renormalizable, and you have this mixing chi. Measures the mixing between the gamma prime and the gamma. For example, this is discussed earlier by Jekyll and Ringwald. There's been a lot of papers on this since then. Okay, so we go through the cosmology, and for non-zero value of alpha in the present universe, we have this dilution of the vector field with respect to the baryon density. And this is what you have for the comparison between lambda CDM. Big G is bigger than G Newton by a factor as much as 10 times bigger. So we have this. You redshift this in your CMP fast calculation to the CMP and use these parameters here. Notice the number of figures. And you get that. I consider this a scary picture. You have basically six parameters, and you have well over 100 data points.
Where's the mass of?
Getting there. Okay, so mass. As the universe expands beyond time of decoupling, eventually you get this dilution of the so-called cold dark matter photon particle. Mach takes over and dominates, and you start fitting all the clusters and galaxies and whatever. I'll show that in a minute. And it turns out that the best fit to the galaxies, as I'll show, are given by these alpha and mu. So this mu, it means the inverse mu is about 24 kiloparsecs. You convert that into electron volts, and this is what the mass is here in the present universe. Whereas the mu is a scalar field that couples to the vector field, for example. So there's a dynamical mechanism for making the vector field mass bigger before recombination. And I don't have time to go into that, but there are papers I've got on this. So this is an ultralight cold dark matter particle that called WISPs, weak, very weakly interacting slim particles. So we conclude, I will conclude, that dark matter particles cannot be detected in the present universe either by the laboratory experiments or in astrophysical observations. The mass is very small, and the coupling is of gravitational strength.
This is dark matter particles within your Waldorf, or?
Sorry, what?
This conclusion is for dark matter particles in your model?
Yes. I hate to make statements like this because someone might find that you can discover this particle, but
basically, this you provision. Have a gravitation-coupled particle, and it is dark matter. This is what you're saying.
That's right. So it couples weakly to the standard model, Quarks and whatever.
Yeah,
there, there,
this,
there are papers. This is not a new idea, by the way.
No, so, how do you produce it early on if it's a vector?
Non-thermally.
How do you produce it non-thermally? It's a vector. Because a vector dilutes with time.
It's what?
Dilutes with time. It's an electric magnetic field, so it dilutes with a scale factor. So
well, let's get into that. I want to talk about this, but I've already thought a lot about this, but I don't have time to go into that. Okay, now, how do I distinguish this theory from dark matter, gravity with dark matter? This is where I get into trouble, because I can reproduce pretty well everything that dark matter people do experimentally. But then someone will ask me, okay, that's great. It's like a Xerox machine, you know, you keep reproducing what the dark matter people do. And how do you know that this theory is correct? Okay, so matter power spectrum. My galaxies do not have dark matter halos, because the so-called dark matter particle dilutes considerably when you go to the first stars and galaxies. So this produces predictions for the dark matter power spectrum. And in particular, you get unit oscillations. And the reason is that the transfer function that produces the power spectrum, if you just have baryons, it's a Bessel function, so it has unit oscillation. This has been known for a long time. The dark matter damps out the unit oscillations in the lambda CDM model. But here, there's no damping, no dark matter. So this is what you get. So you have to put in a window function, MIT window function. You do that, and this is what you find. The red is the picket fence. It's the fit you get using the window function, because you don't have enough galaxies to look at in the big galaxy surveys. The chi-square for this, compared to the blue curve, which is lambda CDM, is as good as lambda CDM. However, there is new data on the matter power spectrum, in particular this paper here. And the data showing tension between lambda CDM, the blue curve, dotted curve, and what they see with the matter power spectrum. So I like to think that I'm already seeing these unit oscillations in the early universe at the time of the first galaxy formation, which is about 3 or 4 million years after the Big Bang. I like to think that. And we're already seeing the distinction between dark matter gravity and my model.
So your model is a red line and the blue line?
Yeah. It's a red. This is just for illustration, by the way. More work has to be done on this. Okay, rotation curves quickly. MNRAS with my collaborators, Sora Brava. We choose a subset of galaxies, and we fix alpha and mu by chi-square, and when we could do 100 galaxies. Without any free parameters, all you need to give me is the mass-to-light ratio. Here's examples of what we get. For the Navarro-Frank-White profiles, you need about at least two parameters, maybe three, for each galaxy. I have no free parameters. I can fit dwarf galaxies, low surface brightness, high surface brightness, and so forth, spirals and whatever. This is good with these parameters here. Does it mean the theory is correct? No. It just means it's encouraging. Okay. This is the latest paper in Physical Review, just came out, where we do fit the latest data going out to 200 kiloparsecs for the Milky Way. And this red curve is what I predict using that alpha mu I showed you. No free parameters. And given the mass of the Milky Way, and you see the excellent fit. This is MOND, Milgram's MOND. It doesn't work because it's flat. This is a six-parameter fit, the dashed line here, using a dark matter halo, six parameters. You can fit with six parameters, but can you fit with no parameters? Yes. Clusters, M and RES. I have to go through this quickly. You have to, what you have to do is you have to find that this M dynamical is equal to M N the baryon in order to fit thermal mass profiles of clusters. And we use the same alpha and mu as we did for the galaxies. And we find that it fits excellent for the clusters. This is the result. Straight line is our result. These are the data. And this is an overall best fit. Bullet cluster, the child, the poster boy of dark matter. It's a cluster, galaxies, clusters that collide. And it was claimed that this proves the existence of dark matter. The dark matter is collisionless. It goes through, the galaxies go through. You have this hot plasma, X-ray plasma, which is kept there by Ram pressure. And you do the microlensing, and you find the dark matter. It's a factor of 6 or 10 times Newton, a Newton's constant. And so with a graduate student, Joel Brownstein, we fitted all this and published a 29-page paper in MNRES and got a press release, which annihilated the press release from NASA, saying that dark matter has to exist. However, there's the result. This is the convergence map, kappa map, which you have to calculate to do the lensing. And this is the data, and this is what we get from my MOG. Good fit.
Why does it fit? Because you actually have a dark matter particle. Actually have a particle of mass that will give you dark matter. So, of course it fits, because you have dark matter.
No, because the dark matter is not visible in the present universe.
It's gravitationally coupled, right? It's still gravitationally
coupled. No, but the mass is highly diluted compared to the baryon density. That's part of the theory. And also the mass is effectively it's very small.
What is the mass of your dark matter in the
present universe? 2.6 times 10 to the minus 28 electron volts. How are you going to get a dark matter halo from that in galaxies?
Yes.
It's too small.
So what keeps that halo? What is the gravitational thing that gravitates that you see?
It's
you have to have intuition. I don't understand this plot.
The Q, the charge for this vector particle, is square root of alpha times g newton times the mass of the body. So it's a gravitational coupling effect. Alpha is of order 1 to 10, or small. Okay, however, there's a problem because a new paper's come out predicting there's another collision. It's called the train wreck collision. And these are two clusters of galaxies that collide. It's called Abel 520, and a paper's come out claiming that there's dark matter here at the center in this system. There's been a lot of controversy about this, and the latest paper claims that they have shown that there is dark matter here. So in order to explain this with dark matter, you need to have a dark matter self-interaction in order to glue the dark matter particles together there where they're not supposed to be there, because they're collisionless with respect to the nucleons. And the strength of the sigma times the sigma over M, cross-section over M, for the self-interacting dark matter is 50 times nuclear strength divided. It's centimeters per, it's about 1.2 centimeters squared per gram. And when you work that out in nuclear physics, it's a 50 times the nuclear strength between two nucleons.
So what is new, by the way, in your model? What is the new parameter? So you had a new parameter that was reported.
It comes into the Yukawa, e to the minus mu r of r.
Yeah, so it's a mass of a particle. So you do have a particle that has a mass here to be dark. So somewhere in your model, there is dark matter.
Yes, but the dark matter is undetectable.
It's gravitational coupled, so what? It is dark matter, right?
Yeah,
it's the definition of dark, right? It doesn't interact with light, so yes.
I can't form sensible dark matter halos from a particle with a mass of 10 to the minus 28 electrons.
No, but you have another mass parameter, which is mu.
Yeah.
That's a mass, and if you have a Yukawa that corresponds, you have a scalar field that has a mass of 10 to the minus 23 or whatever, 22, whatever that is. So,
yeah.
So that is your dark matter.
Yes, but it doesn't, it's not visible at present.
What do you
do you want to do? You want to do a cavity experiment and find a dark matter particle.
Okay, that we agree. So it's
way below in mass.
Yeah,
below.
Yeah, I agree. So you do have a dark matter particle. It just has no laboratory signature.
It's not detectable.
Yes, okay, good. But yes, it's dark. Yes, we agree.
It's not detect. It's not. It's too has too small a mass here. If you do try to fit the Bulle cluster with this thing, I've done it. It doesn't work. Okay. It's not difficult to prove.
It doesn't cluster gravitationally.
I
mean, detectable in the sense of its other interactions, apart from gravity.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
No, I agree. So, all three for dark matter.
His point is that it doesn't cluster in the sense of dark matter as you know, some sort of matter fluid clusters, so it can't form dark matter halos.
No, but there is a new parameter that appears to be a mass. Because it mediates in Yukawa force. So there is a light scalar field in the field.
Right.
And that can cluster. And that's not the particle.
Massive scalars and massive variables and so on don't interact gravitationally the same way, right? I mean, the particle content is important. Right? I mean, just because there's a mass scalar, it doesn't mean that it clusters in the same way that ordinary dark matter, the way we describe it, clusters gravitationally.
Well, it has to come.
Maybe we can discuss this later.
Okay, go ahead.
I should emphasize that this mass of 2.6 times 10 to the minus 28 electron volts is fixed by all the cluster fits, Bulle cluster fit, and the galaxy fits, which is significant. It's not just plucked out of the air. Okay. Now, let's get to the main act, strong gravity. So, if you take the field equations of my action, from my action, then you get this set of equations as just ignoring in the present universe that this mass, okay, which is reasonable. By the way, from the particle data group, the bound on the mass of the photon is 3 times 10 to the 14 electron volts, 10 to the minus 14 electron volts. If you use galactic magnetic fields, it's 4 times 10 to the minus 27 electron volts. This is a very controversial issue. What is the mass of the photon? And Coulomb, if you use Coulomb's law, it comes out around 10 to the minus 14 electron volts, which is not zero, especially by your axion stuff. This is the photon. However, the photon is a gauge particle. And in order to make QED work, renormalization, It has to have a zero mass. Now, you solve, this is the energy momentum tensor for the vector field. B is the curl of the vector field, B mu nu. And these are Maxwell type equations. Everything is fixed. You solve the equations, you get an exact solution. And now I put into this Reiser-Nordstrom type solution my gravitational source charge for the vector field. And I put this G equal to G Newton 1 plus alpha, which is needed to fit the galaxies. And I choose Q to be positive, so you get always get a repulsive force. I need this to fit the galaxies and the clusters.
Isn't there a bound of Q from fifth force experiment? What about fifth force experiment?
Which experiment?
Fifth force experiment. If matter is charged under this vector field, there's going to be four, a vector field exchange when you do laboratory tests.
Yeah, but with this small mass again, and with the if you work this out, you don't violate the equivalence principle. I checked this, the weak equivalence principle. These are old experiments that go back years. The fifth, I used to go to those conferences, by the way. Anyway, keep going here.
Why? Sorry? Well, how? What is the screening mechanism? You say Q, what the, so if I have a...
Ah, okay. What is the screening mechanism? The screening mechanism is that if you go back to this modified gravitational law, there. When mu, remember, inverse of mu is 24 kiloparsecs. So if you put that in and go to the sun, the Earth, this is of order 1, that's gone. Alpha cancels alpha, you get Newton. That's the screening mechanism. It's built into the theory.
So is there a correspondence?
This guarantees that you agree with all solar system experiments.
Is there a corresponding configuration for the scalar field for the metric you just saw? You just saw the metric, solution for the metric.
This
right?
is a modified Newtonian acceleration law.
No, I mean at the slide you showed before the one that you went back to. I mean the last slide in your talk that you were talking about.
The Warhol things.
Sorry. Which one?
The one with the Schwarzschild-like solution.
Oh, the light, you mean the gamma conversion?
No, the one with the metric for the spherical symmetric.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So with the charge.
Right.
I mean, there's a corresponding solution for the scalar field, right? There's a scalar field configuration in the space-time.
Yeah.
So how is that like?
Maybe we can talk about that later. Now, astrophysical bodies do not have electric charge because there are enough ions around in any gravitational body, including black holes, so that this system immediately neutralizes. It's very easy. This doesn't neutralize because Q is a gravitational source and Q is positive. So this solution has these two horizons, R plus and minus. And it means that when alpha is zero, you just get the Schwarzschild horizon. When alpha is non-zero, you never have a horizon-free solution with a naked singularity. So when you work out the temperature of this MOG, I call it a MOG black hole, from surface gravity you get this result. Alpha zero, you get the usual Hawking temperature for Schwarzschild black hole. And the lifetime of the black hole is given here, the MOG black hole.
John, am I missing something? To me it looks like it's just exactly the Reiser-Nordstrom. Within your approximation, it seems that the mass of this zero, right? So
you mean there's no mass?
I thought that's what you did.
Well, no, if there's no mass, there's no gravity, including there's no modern gravity.
Okay,
you only have mass.
So when you're doing this, the mass still is, you did not set the mass of the vector field to zero once.
It's the mass of the black hole or the star or whatever.
No, no, no. Is the mass of your additional degrees of freedom in this, have you approximated it to be zero or none?
For this particular black hole solution, it's an exact solution, a vacuum solution, so there's no approximation.
It's independent of the mass.
But if you go far enough out
from
the black hole, you get the Schwarzschild solution with mass.
So there has to be an exponential that's missing from what you wrote down.
The exponential is not relevant here because 24 kiloparsecs kills the Yukawa at the size of a black hole.
Well, you can't say it's exact and then you can't say there's a piece that's missing.
It's the exact solution.
Then there's something that's missing where you set the mass to zero.
Which mass?
The mass of your
mu.
Your mu.
Mu is just ignored because the mass is 10 to minus 28 electron volts.
So
it's a massless vector.
Yeah, so this is just exactly.
It is, that's right.
So you approximate it as exactly the Schwarzschild one. Reisner-Nordström.
Right. But it has different, significantly different consequences, as we'll see.
So you have two parameters, two mass parameters. There is mu and there is m of 5. How are they different? Because that mu that was entering there was 10 to the minus 23, around 10 to the minus 23 eV, while m phi is
10 to the minus 28.
No, there is mu and there is m phi.
Yeah.
What is mu?
Mu is inverse of mu is 24 kiloparsecs.
Yes, which is 10 to the minus 23, right?
And when you convert that into electron volts, you can do it easy. It's 2.6 times 10 to the minus 28. Electron volts. Okay, so we move on. I now can construct a regular solution of Mach, and this is based on work by Aon, Beto, and Garcia, Physical Review Letters, 1998. It's again an exact solution, and what one does is we choose a nonlinear beam in new field. It's like nonlinear electrodynamics. And this is what you have for the field. And Gino naught behaves like this for large R. And this is what this is the gravitational solution, charge solution for the radial component of beam mu.
So I'm going to go through this. What is the difference between this line and the previous one? So this is a black hole depends or not solution that is regular direct material. So what's the ratio
that you're starting in the previous one? What you do is you take this field, construct the energy momentum tensor for a smooth beam in your field, okay, which is not the same as Maxwell. And then you solve the equations, and this is what you get.
Now, what is the physical scenario in this versus the previous one that you showed?
This is a new scenario.
And what's zero? How is that different? So what's the difference?
Well, there's no singularity at r equal to zero.
So you set up the same boundary conditions and you require no singularity?
Asymptotic flatness,
da-da-da. So what about the singularity theorems?
Sorry, what?
So what, you're claiming we would get a regular black hole with a massive positive mass vector field and massive scalar?
Massive scalar.
I thought there was a massive scalar. Maybe I misunderstood.
Okay, so for small r, this is how the metric behaves. And it's, in fact, it becomes a de Sitter or anti de Sitter inside the black hole. There was a paper published by me and Leonardo Modesto and Pierre Nicolini about 3 or 4 years ago, where we said that the singularity of r equal to zero is removed by quantum gravity. And we used a non-local quantum gravity theory, which I published, which is finite about that. And we found the same result, that the interior of the black hole is de Sitter. And of course, de Sitter has no singularities at r equal to zero. So the two coincide. This is a classical solution that's regular, whereas the one I published was a quantum gravity solution. We need to get rid of the singularity at r equal to zero. Now, this particular solution, there's a critical value of alpha. When alpha is less than alpha critical, you get two horizons. It's an eighth order polynomial, but it reduces to two roots when you calculate the horizon. But now R is greater than R critical. There is no horizon and no naked singularity. So this is not a black hole, but it looks like a black hole to the observer outside, which is very black, okay? Gray. I call it a gray hole. So this is the Penrose diagram for the MOG solution with two horizons, and there's never a naked singularity solution for this.
Sorry, I just don't understand the previous claim. So if there's no horizon, why would it look like a black hole to an outside observer? There's no horizon, I could send signals from deep inside to the observer. Why would the observer think there is a horizon?
This is a good question. I thought a lot about this thing about what does it mean not to have a black hole, even though it's black looking. But anyway, we can talk about that later. This is the Penrose diagram for the regular solution, of course. There's no horizon, and there's no singularity not equal to zero. Okay, so now I turn to what I call Kerr-Mogg solution, Kerr solution, spinning black hole. This is the solution I get. And again, these are the horizons, and there's an ergosphere. G0 not 0, delta equals 0. Delta is given here. Now we get to experimental data. What do we know about black holes? Virtually nothing. Everything we know about black holes is theoretical, except for the fact that at the center of the Sagittarius constellation, is an object with a mass of 4.3 times 10 to the 6th solar masses. Okay. Does it have a horizon? We don't know. Is it a Schwarzschild solution? We don't know. It's amazing that so many thousands of papers have been published on black holes, theoretically, without understanding anything about the observational data. However, things are changing. Because you now, what I do is I put a photosphere around my MOG black hole. And these are bound photons in orbit. And I also have to take into account the lensing of the black hole from distant stars behind the black hole. And it turns out that the black hole casts a shadow. I'll explain this in more detail in a minute. And from the shadow, the boundary of the shadow is only determined by the geometry, because we have to worry about the accretion disk around the black hole. So determining the shadow observationally can tell us geometrically what a black hole is. This is amazing, okay, and very exciting.
Waves look like here?
I'll get to that. I checked that. This is an important point. The binary pulsars are killer for gravity theories, but I have a way of solving it. Okay. Now, so what you produce is celestial coordinates. This is a distant observer. This is the black hole. We give it a spin, so there's a spin axis. This is the apparent position, and this is what you see. The size of the photosphere is given by my MOG by this, just the mass and Newton's constant and alpha. And this is the size of the shadow. So for a non-rotating shadow radius, you can approximate this thing by that very simple formula. It's linear in alpha. So when alpha increases, you get a large difference between a Schwarzschild black hole and a MOG black hole. And you can begin to clearly see the difference, we hope, within 2 years. Okay, for the Kerr, similar problem I solve for this. This is the case for a non-rotating situation. And this is what I find for the X and Y celestial coordinates. I plug it in to my computer code and run it. What they're doing is linking up millimeter telescopes, the radio frequency telescope. You need a very small wavelength in the radio wave frequency, around, say, 400 gigaparsec, in order to get small enough resolution to see the boundary of the black hole, the shadow. Okay? And they're getting close. What they've done is build a telescope. They've used the BICET 2 telescope and put in a different telescopic small wavelength detector, heat detector. In fact, they've already found a picture of the moon, the heat of the moon. It's very interesting. So once they've linked all these systems together, they're going to link to the ALMA telescope in Mexico, Atacama telescope. Within 2 years, the claim is they will be able to, with this very large baseline array, determine the shadow of the black hole. There it is. This is from our own Avery Broderick, from his simulation. And this is the ring. This in here, this is the annihilation of matter, an accretion disk. This is a photosphere ring. And this is the shadow of the black hole. Now, what I do is I run it. I have a computer program. I run it, plug in my MOG solution, and vary alpha. And for the case of Schwarzschild, where the curve parameter A is connected to the angular momentum, when A is 0, I get this. When A is 0.16, I get the same, because A comes in squared in the calculation. When I go to an extreme black hole, A is 0.95, near the speed of light, I do begin to see a deformation. So we're not expecting to see black holes with this kind of angular momentum. So it's not, from my point of view, it's not going to be easy to determine the spin of the Sagittarius A star.
What about measurements of measured spins of black holes? What do you think those?
What measurements?
There are measurements of spins of stellar black holes and also supermassive black
holes. Oh, you mean binary black holes?
He's referring here to the two that would be accessible by the BLDI, so that's Sagittarius A and Andromeda.
But what about the spin determination? You're saying that you shouldn't be able to observe fast relocating.
Probably not.
But what about the measurements that are there?
I don't know of any measurements. There are simulations.
No, there are measurements.
Wait, they are
saying. No.
With respect to this one, there are simulations. Ah. And there are measurements, quote unquote, with respect to models. For both stellar and supermassive black holes, that's what
you're
referring to.
Yes.
Well, I'm talking about the supermassive black holes.
Yes.
But supermassive black
holes. M87 and Sagittarius A star.
Those two.
We have no spin measurements for them. Okay, so let's move to my MOG solutions. Again, I'm increasing alpha from 0 to, say, 9. And they show the significant difference between Schwarzschild and the MOG. You can detect this difference. And then I move on to my Kerr-MOG solutions. And the trouble is that when I increase alpha, I find that the deformation due to spin is not significant. It tends to reduce the effect of the spin. This is showing the different solutions. Okay, now, there's a star moving around in a highly elliptical orbit around Sagittarius A star, the center of the galaxy. And these are the observational values for the orbit. Semi-major axis, centricity, period, so on. And so I worked out the periastron shift. And it's 0.18 degrees per 5 years. This is a real strong gravity test. Okay? You have to compare this with the advance, perihelion advance of Mercury, 43 arc seconds per century. It's an enormous difference. However, when I do my Mach calculation from the orbital trajectory, I get the same answer as this. So I can use this to distinguish my Mach modified gravity from GR. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. There's a picture of this is a teapot. It's sitting just above the spout of the teapot. And this is a picture of the S2 or SO2 elliptical motion. The eccentricity is 0.883. It's quite very eccentric orbit. Finally, I did this for fun as an intellectual exercise. Can I construct a wormhole solution from my Mach solution, black hole solution? And the answer is yes. This is based on a paper by Schein and Eckelberg, Physical Review Letters, 1996. So what you have is two spheres connected, S1 and S2, by what's called a Mayumta-Papapetrometric. The Mach gravitational attraction, the repulsive vector field, balances the throat of the wormhole throat makes it stable. In GR, a wormhole throat is not stable, it pinches off. And you need exotic dark matter to make a wormhole, traversable wormhole.
So where's the, if I go to the Einstein frame, where's the violation of the net coming? Or are you saying something else?
You mean the null energy condition? Well, we'll talk about that later. This is a complicated question. Okay, there's a picture of the wormhole. As we know, it's a bridge. Two asymptotically flat parts of the universe are connected through this wormhole. So I solved the problem that Professor Brandt was working on in the film Interstellar. You remember he and his daughter were trying to find a traversable wormhole. And I could have sent this to him. To me, this is science fiction, but I find it fun. So I'm not going to appear in some blog site as being a science fiction physicist. Now, finally, what have I achieved? I'm afraid I covered up the top. It says experimental data fitted by Mach, that's what it said. So to date, I can fit the early universe cosmology. I fit the bullet cluster. I'm working at present on the ABLE 520. Norman Israel is a student in the States, in California, and we're working this out together. And we rechecked the calculation published in MNRES for the bullet cluster. It works. And we have to deal with this, the 520, ABLE 520. And we're working on that now. We have to get the raw data from Hubble, reconvert it, and then calculate the lensing Kappa map, the surface density secret, da-da-da-da-da-da. This is fairly straightforward. Gravitational lensing, yeah. The binary pulsar. The binary pulsar is a killer because the Halsey-Taylor binary pulsar data is very accurate. And it tells you how much energy is radiated, gravitational energy is radiated, as the two masses go around one another. And in gravitational radiation, you do not detect any dipole radiation, because the dipole radiation is just the time derivative of the center of mass momentum divided by the center of mass energy, the total mass of the binary, zero, obviously, because of Newton's third law. And the quadrupole radiation is worked out, it's pretty precise, and you have to deal with this. Now I have this vector field. And it could have.
Is it just a vector field or is there also scalar? How many fields?
Oh, you can't have it here because I just have mass. You don't have monopole radiation in the theory just with mass as a source, because m dot is zero for an isolated system. But the dipole is something else. Now, in this case, my Q is always positive, so I can't have a dipole. So the dipole radiation is zero.
Wait,
but the quadrupole radiation...
If you have two unequal things, you're going to get a dipole.
Hmm?
If you have two... unless both pulsars have the same mass, you're going to have a dipole.
The dipole radiation is D double dot, but D is a dipole, plus or minus charge.
Yeah, no, but it's just a difference between the two. And your Q is strictly proportional to mass, yes?
Yeah, but there's a charge,
your
vector field. Anyway, we'll talk about this later. I'm near the end. Yeah, so I solved this problem. There's no dipole radiation. And the quadrupole radiation excess is screened off because of my gravitational radiation equations for Mach. Solar system, yeah, fitted all of that. Strong gravity event horizon telescope of black holes. Well, it's a question mark. And I have a clear distinction between my modified gravity and TR, as you saw. And according to Avery Broderick, they should be able to tell the difference, which can be significant. So we wait.
Maybe I have misunderstood something, but I thought you said that there is a scalar excitation in the theory, that there is a scalar particle, right? If there is a scalar particle, then you can have monopole radiation, and you can have also a Yukawa type correction with Unicorn potential. So, I mean, you're obtaining your solar system tests by neglecting the scalar.
Which scalar?
I thought you said that there is a scalar particle which plays the role of dark matter, and then it's mass.
It's not scalar, it's vector.
Your G. So you have this scalar vector G plus your vector, yes?
Yeah.
But there is a scalar.
There is a scalar.
No, but the scalar is like Jordan Prime's ticket. It doesn't couple directly to matter like Jordan Prime's ticket.
It doesn't matter if it's
coupled
directly
to
matter,
right?
If
you have a Prime's ticket, it doesn't
couple
to matter. Yeah. Only through the curvature.
No, that's enough.
Big G is a scalar.
Always in the question is time order equal to the trace of your matter times the scalar field.
So it always couples. Exactly. That's exactly my confusion for the past hour. So
I mean,
even in Bragg's theory,
you get a Yukawa type correction to the Newtonian potential.
So there's an additional correction. If it's massless, you know that it cannot be there. So, if it's massive,
you constrain a combination within whatever the Brownian parameter is in the mass. And if the mass is light, then it's visible because you can excite it easily, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
basically, with the principle test, they're extremely sensitive.
And the same goes for monopole radiation. If you have a very light scalar field, then it's very easy to excite it. So, you expect that you lose radiation, into more and more radiation for the scalar field.
But these scalar theories are screened by chameleon mechanisms.
No, they are not screened by chameleon mechanisms.
But you have not shown that.
This is a scalar field, but they know how to couple. This is the Brunsticky theory. It's very constrained. This alpha parameter in a Brunsticky theory is very constrained. Because of the equivalence principle test, you exchange the scalar field at the equivalence principle test. And this is the vector field you've been talking about.
Yeah.
This is my confusion. The scalar field is potential.
Scalar field is big G.
Yes, big G.
Yeah.
Yes,
but
there's a scalar excitation of that field.
Well, let's talk about this after. Okay. Right, so conclusions. That this goal is to explain everything in gravity with this action at the beginning. And my claim is that I've succeeded in a lot of it. This required an enormous amount of work. And I do it myself with two or three collaborators. Every time I do one item, I'm faced with the next one. So there we have to deal with the black hole shadows, and we look forward to the Event Horizon Telescope results. Thank you. Yeah, when you do the gravitational wave solid, you have to combine the quadrupole radiation from the vector field. In electromagnetism, the electric field potential has a quadrupole radiation. So I have to combine that with the quadrupole radiation from the spin too. And I solve the retarded solution, etc., etc. And I find that in the wave zone, I don't see any excess of gravitational radiation for quadrupole, which is important. I'm writing a paper on this at present.
But there is the issue of the scale.
We'll have to argue about this.
I
thought a lot about this, okay? So let's talk about it later.
Okay, thanks.